Hello, my name is David Hart. I'm the director of Liberty Fund's Online Library of Liberty. I'm talking today to Henry Clark, who's professor of history at Canisius College in Buffalo, New York. His area of research is in the field of the French and Scottish Enlightenment, and has published a book on La Rochefoucauld and the idea of commercial society in 17th and 18th century France. I'd like to talk to Hank about a book he had published with Liberty Fund in 2003 called Commerce, Culture and Liberty, Readings on Capitalism Before Adam Smith. Hello, Hank, welcome.
Nice to be here, David.
What is your book about?
Well, it's a collection of readings on the subject of commerce in its broadest possible conception in the 17th and 18th century. The idea was to present some of the writings on capitalism before 1776, which was the year that Adam Smith wrote his book, The Wealth of Nations, which we normally think of as the beginning of sort of the modern intellectual history of capitalism.
And why did you write this book?
I wrote it because I think that Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations is widely misunderstood as being a work that feeds only into the modern technical science of economics. And I thought that much has been lost by that way of reading the book, and that much could be recaptured by seeing the broader context in which his work appeared, a context that included topics such as the moral and cultural and political life of the 17th and 18th century that are reflected in the book's readings.
I notice in the collection of material you have in the book that you seem to place quite a high importance on the contribution of French writers, and particularly some of the physiocrats. Why did you do that?
Well, it's true. About a third or so of the readings in the book were originally written in French, mostly by Frenchmen. It's also true that Adam Smith, like David Hume, his fellow Scotsman, went to France for an extended visit and met with many of the intellectual luminaries of the period. And it's also true, as you say, that the physiocrats were of particular interest to Smith. He nearly dedicated The Wealth of Nations to the leading figure in the physiocratic school, Dr. Quesnay. But I would also emphasize that he was greatly interested in the work of Montesquieu and of other figures who are not physiocrats. And so the French influence on the development of 18th century thought about economics was really quite broad and multivalent, we might say.
And of course, France was one of the leading countries of the Enlightenment. In fact, French was the language of the Enlightenment, wouldn't you say?
It certainly was, and in fact, one of Adam Smith's earliest writings was a book review, actually, of Rousseau's Second Discourse. He wrote it in the Edinburgh Review in 1755. At that point, he was a young man, just beginning his university career, but it's clear that he already knew French, as Hume and most other Scottish intellectuals did as well.
So we can assume that he read widely in French political theory and economic thought.
We know that for a fact. In fact, students' notes that we have from as early as the 1750s indicate that he is already alluding to his students to French authors that he expects that they would be familiar with, such as Montesquieu, for instance.
In the 18th century, there was a different style of writing economics. Some people have described it as a kind of philosophical history, even a kind of early sociology. It's not technical in the sense of a lot of mathematics. Would you agree with that?
I would, and in fact, I would go further than that, David, and say the following. Smith's lectures on economics were originally a part of a university curriculum that that included a course of instruction on his part in moral philosophy. And in his own course on moral philosophy, he divided the subject matter into natural theology, ethics, justice or jurisprudence and utility, that is to say, administration, revenue, arms, military, and what we would call economic issues. And so all of these topics were connected together in his mind and in the mind of many of his contemporaries in the 1750s and 60s.
One of the things that you note in your introduction to this anthology is the importance of moral issues in the writings of many of these authors. Why is that?
Well, partly it's just because of the point I just made, which is that it was originally part of a university curriculum on moral philosophy. And partly, too, I think it's because the concept of moral inquiry in the 18th century included not only what we might call normative questions, such as what is right and what is wrong, what are the virtues, what are the vices, but also what the French meant by morality, or la morale, which was a study of the manners and mores of a people. And it was coming to be appreciated, I think, in many parts of Europe in the 18th century, that manners, mores, and customs were a critically important thing to understand if one wanted to understand the society as a whole, including in its economic dimension.
And of course, what we see throughout the 18th century is an increasing impact of commerce on European society and the effect in particular it had on traditional structures within European society.
Well, and that actually puts the horse in front of the cart, because, of course, all of these thinkers that we would be talking about in a discussion of 17th and 18th century Europe are coming from societies that are originally agricultural societies, overwhelmingly. And so commerce is the new kid on the block. It's the new activity that somehow has to be accommodated. It has to be integrated into pre-existing attitudes, pre-existing values and ideas and senses of the good life and the good political and social order. And so that, too, I think, has to inform our understanding of what they had to say about economic topics, properly speaking.
Would you say that many of these writers have an ambivalent attitude towards the impact of commerce? On the one hand, they see it as being quite corrosive of traditional social structures, but on the other hand, they also see it as a way of tying disparate people together through trade.
Absolutely. I couldn't have put it better myself. The 18th century thinkers had, I think, a much more nuanced and capacious view of the possibilities of what we think of as capitalism than is the case often in late 20th and early 20th century thought. And that's one of the things that I had in mind in putting together this anthology. There was a rich tradition of reflection on moral life and on social structure that is presupposed in the discussion about commerce in 18th century Europe.
There's a lot of discussion also about so-called luxury. What does luxury mean to a 17th or 18th century writer, and why were they concerned about it?
Well, again, that's a natural outgrowth, I think, of the fact that these European societies were mostly subsistence-based societies. Commerce began to create classes of people who were further and further removed from subsistence ways of life. And I think luxury meant different things to different people depending upon what country you were in. In a monarchical country like France, for instance, luxury very often tended to connote the court, and it tended to be pitted against the rest of society. In England, there was some of that, to be sure, but the court didn't weigh so heavily. Luxury then came to be a kind of engine of consumer, what many scholars in the last 25 years have called a consumer revolution that occurred between, say, 1700 or so and 1800. And yet... The concept of luxury was a very old one, and it had rich affiliations with the seven deadly sins of the Middle Ages and the other moral and even theological language left over from the Middle Ages. And so luxury was probably the single most resonant term for really joining the debate over commercial society, how open to be towards it, how accommodating, how supportive that there was in the 18th century.
And of course, one of the things that the commercial revolution and the industrial revolution achieves is that what were once luxury items now become more readily available to a broader mass of people. And of course, governments like to tax luxuries, don't they? There was all these countries had luxury taxes.
Well, of course, the sumptuary laws went back a very, very long time, and what you call the luxury tax was just an 18th century variant on that. But your other point is interesting, too. You know, Rousseau, in the middle of the 18th century, in the 1750s, was already talking about the process by which goods that had begun as luxury goods and had been savored and enjoyed as something new and interesting were already beginning to become virtual necessities, which is a phenomenon, of course, that that critics of capitalism in the 20th century are quite familiar with as well.
So luxury is much like this iPod in front of us.
Well, I know a certain son, 14 years old, who would consider an iPod to be pretty darn close to a necessity.
Essential item, yeah. Something else you discuss in your introduction, which I thought was very interesting, was the impact that the commercial revolution has on women and their traditional role in society. Would you care to say something about that?
Yes, I would. It's often said by critics of capitalism in the 20th century in particular that capitalism is part of a system that oppresses women. Marx certainly was an important and powerful voice in articulating the idea that capitalism, by turning everything into a commodity, including women in the marriage arena, dehumanizes and degrades women. And what I find interesting about many of these 18th century authors is that they are already beginning to see that the broad civilizing and humanizing effects of a reciprocal voluntary trade also has a humanizing and emancipating effect on women as well. And so it offers us a voice, a useful alternative voice to the voice that many of us are familiar with in academic circles.
And of course, one of the things that occurs during the 18th century are economic opportunities that women didn't have before, in particular working at home, doing piecework, sort of the earliest phases of the Industrial Revolution.
That is true as well, and in fact, this burst on the scene during the French Revolution as well, where you have women beginning to make claims in the marketplace that had not been made before. But even before the French Revolution, you're also right that liberalizing thinkers in different parts of Europe, even going back to The Spectator, for instance, in the first couple of decades of the 18th century in England, are beginning to articulate a place for women in commercial life that is much more various, much more diverse, has many more different kinds of opportunities than had existed before.
In your research, did you come across any women authors who were writing on these economic issues?
In the 17th and 18th century, alas, I did not find any that I was able to propose for this anthology. I consulted with experts in the history of female writing in the 17th and 18th century on this topic, and they too were unable to suggest the names of female authors who had distinctive and novel and influential things to say about the subject. Now, of course, some of the characters who are written about, for instance, in The Spectator, are female characters, But that's a different thing again.
So perhaps it was only in the 19th century that we begin to see women authors commenting on economic issues. And I'm thinking here of Harriet Martineau and Jane Marcet in particular in England.
I think you're probably right about that, and I think that's probably also the case in France as well.
When you look through the list of names in the table of contents, you see a large number of French names, which is good, quite a few English names, but also other languages are represented, for example, the Dutch, the Italians, Spanish. So it seems like this commentary on the economic changes that were occurring in this period was a European-wide phenomenon.
I think that's partly true. I do think that most European commentators associate the idea of a commercial society, at first at least, in the 17th century, with Holland and England. After that, you have a broadening out of the discussion. Certainly in the 18th century, France is added. You certainly have a very vigorous Italian contribution. You have people going back and looking at the Italian republics of the Middle Ages, late Middle Ages and Renaissance, as models of commercial countries, Florence and Venice in particular. Generally speaking, I think that in the 18th century, it's England, France, and Holland that are the leading contributors to a European-wide discourse on commercial society. But what's also interesting is that enlightened rulers in other countries wanted to get in on the act. And so you have, for instance, physiocrats being invited to as faraway places as Russia to serve as advisors on the economic policies of a Catherine the Great, for instance.
Something which happened again during the 1980s.
History, the more things change, the more they remain the same sometimes, isn't it?
The title of your book is Commerce, Culture, and Liberty. What do all these precursors to Adam Smith have to tell us today about liberty?
Well, it's remarkable to me how similar some of the debates that took place in the 18th century are to some of the debates that take place at our own time. And by our own time, I mean both the Cold War, which was going on when you and I were coming of age, but also the post-Cold War period, which we might call an age of globalization, where the debate is not exactly the same, but still of a family resemblance to what it was during the Cold War. One similarity in particular is, in the 18th century, there was a debate over the degree of dependence that an individual experiences on other people when he or she enters into market relations, and whether that dependence is an inhibiting or an emancipating sort of phenomenon. In the 18th century, it was a debate really between Hume and Smith on the one side and Rousseau on the other, and their various and sundry followers. And in our own time as well, I think that the critics of globalization will talk about a dependency theory, for instance, as a way of conceptualizing the relationship between what we used to call the first world, that is the industrialized world, and what we used to call the third world, or the undeveloped world, developing world, Latin America, Africa, and even Asia, although less and less so now. So I think that what this book does is, A, it certainly reminds us that many of the problems that we consider to be unique about our own time are not unique. They have at least a family resemblance to problems that have existed in the past. And B, they give us a slightly different model, a slightly different variant on the whole debate, so that we can see ourselves more clearly in the mirror, as it were, when we are participating in our own debates today.
What has been the reception of your book since it was published?
Well, I've been very pleased, actually, about the reception of the book. I've been told by friends and colleagues and people I've not met that they have found it to be a book that teaches well, which is one of the things that I had hoped would happen to the book, that in the classroom it works very well as a way of introducing students to the history of the 17th and 18th centuries as a whole, and especially the intellectual history of capitalism. I've been told that by people who teach a range of different fields: French history, intellectual history, the history of social thought, political theory. People have used it and found it useful. So generally speaking, I've been very pleased about the reception so far.
What are you currently working on?
Well, here at Liberty Fund, I have been working on two projects actually this year. One is the first ever, I believe, English translation of the entire Pensée of Montesquieu. This was a kind of intellectual diary that he maintained from 1720 or so until his death in 1755. It contains rich material on his moral thought, but also on the kinds of topics that he wrote about in his Considerations on Rome, 1734, and his Spirit of the Laws, which came out in 1748. And it's a longish work, and so I've been spending quite a bit of time on it. The second project that I've been working on is an anthology of political articles taken from the Encyclopédie. That was the major 17-volume work edited by Diderot and D'Alembert from 1751 until 1772, if you count the 11 volumes of plates as well. This was simply one of the major, if not the major, intellectual enterprise of 18th century Europe. It involved over 140 contributors. It was a major commercial venture, a major publishing venture, and a major flashpoint in the debates over everything from science to theology to history to policy. And this too is unprecedented. I'm taking about 60 or so articles from the 17 volumes that concern political topics, and I'm hoping to be able to put them into an anthology that will again be both instructive reading for the general reader, but also will be usable in the classroom as a way of teaching the intellectual history of Europe and of the French Enlightenment.
You could probably think of several such anthologies that one could draw out of the encyclopedia. I mean, you could have a whole anthology devoted to science and technology, or to history perhaps, or certainly to economics. There would be an interesting collection of economic articles that would
and
could draw out of that.
Absolutely. And among the things that Diderot in particular was keenly interested in was all the new arts, crafts, and techniques of the period. His father was a cutler, and he was very very at home in the workshop. And he did, in fact, go around and talk to people about their tools. You're absolutely right. There are a number of things that could be done with this.
When I was teaching my first-year students about the French Enlightenment, I used to show them some of the engravings from this wonderful encyclopedia. And one in particular I enjoyed showing was an illustration of how cleverly they would insinuate political commentary into an illustration that might just be about, appear on the surface to be about technology. And the one I have in mind was the iron ore manufacturer. And what they had was a quite detailed illustration showing the internal workings of all these scientific and technological processes. But standing in the picture was a tax collector. someone writing down, you know, how much the new industrialists would have to pay in taxes. And it was quite a clever way in which you could kill two birds with one stone, talk about political change and economic change and also technological change.
Well, it's an interesting observation. Contemporaries were well aware of what the editors were doing. They comment upon it all the time. And not the least interest in the work was the constant struggle against the censorship apparatus in France, which included the Parlement of Paris, it included the Archbishop of Paris and the Roman Catholic Church more generally. It certainly included the monarchy, the Royal Council. They ran afoul of all of these institutions at one point or another during the course of the publication. And in fact, for years, the publication was suspended by order of the French government. So the work itself is an assertion of the human need to express itself, and is a triumph of intellectual freedom in and of itself. And so I think this will be a contribution once it's done.
What would you say to younger scholars who are looking for areas of research to go into? What would you recommend as an area that would best increase our understanding of liberty?
Well, that's a large question, and I can think of a number of possible answers to it. Certainly, it seems to me that at least for the next generation or two in the United States, and probably in the Western world as a whole, what we call entitlement programs, or what might be called the welfare state, the état-providence in France, has to be considered a major area of concern. It's going to be one of the most contested areas of public life in the next 50 years for a whole bunch of different reasons, and it has enormous implications for liberty. And I think that friends of liberty, if we will call them that, can do well both by doing research in that area and by finding ways of conveying to the general public the liberty interest in, let's say, state pension programs, what we call Social Security, or state health care programs, public education, the whole gamut of government activity in the domestic sphere would, it seems to me at least, to be a priority of the very first importance. Secondly, for other parts of the world, I would think that globalization is going to be on the cutting edge for some time to come, making the case that international trade is in the interests of those many states and societies who are not quite convinced of that yet. And of course, one has to count, when one looks at things like agricultural policy, one has to count Europe and the United States in this area as well. But as we become a more and more interconnected world, I think that international trade issues are going to be more and more important. And then the third and final point that I would make in response to that question, David, is simply this. I think that in America, at least, there always seems to be a temptation on the part of people to look upon our constitutional order as being sort of on automatic pilot. And even though constitutional studies are often looked upon as among the least exciting and scintillating and fascinating areas of research, I think that educating the public about the liberty interest in our constitutional order is a continual concern and a continual struggle, and there will always be room for good research in that area as well.
What about continuing in the area of this particular book, what you called the intellectual history of capitalism? Are there still periods of history or particular countries where further exploration is needed?
Absolutely. My own anthology is really only a starting point. It includes nothing on the German scene. It includes nothing on the Spanish scene. It includes very little on the Italian scene, and it begins around 1650. There was a lot of very interesting work being done, a lot of very interesting things being said between, say, 1492 and 1650, it would be most useful and interesting to know about. A combination of laziness and incompetence prevented me from including any of that material
in my
own anthology.
So you didn't speak enough languages to cover the entire field.
Well,
even Chinese. I mean, there must be some interesting work done in Chinese that we just know nothing about.
I have little doubt of it. Mm. I think there'd certainly be room for studies of that kind.
I've asked you to select some key passages in your book. Would you care to read some of those out?
I'd be delighted, yes. I've chosen three, and the first one is...
Perhaps you could say what page it was on.
Yes, it's on page 19. This is chapter 9 of Peter Delacourt's Political Maxims of the State of Holland. I would say that... this work, which is only anthologized here, is one of the most surprising and welcome discoveries that people make when they read this anthology. And the passage that I read is simply the chapter title of chapter 9 on page 19. It reads as follows: that the inhabitants of Holland, being in a state of freedom, are by a common interest wonderfully linked together, which is also showed by a rough calculation of the number of inhabitants and by what means they subsist. Now here, it seems to me, even in this chapter title, we have a fine, succinct statement of what a commercial society Holland already is in many ways in the 17th century. He wrote this in 1662. And how liberty is an absolutely essential characteristic of that society. I also would point out in this passage that Delacourt's call for a calculation of the number of inhabitants is interesting as well. Because what it seems to presuppose is that all of the inhabitants are of equal importance, as opposed to a traditional European society in which you're interested in the nobility, you're interested in the clergy, but no one would think of counting the inhabitants as a whole on the assumption that they are all of equal importance. A call for estate statistics on Delacourt's part is one that would be picked up many, many times in the future.
Before you go to the next one, let me just say that partly as because of the inspiration and your enthusiasm for Delacourt, this work will be going online on the Online Library of Liberty later this year, which I think will be an important milestone.
I think it'll be an important milestone too. It fills an important gap and it helps people to understand things that otherwise could not properly be understood about the discussion that was evolving in France and England in the late 17th and 18th century. My second passage is from Montesquieu.
Your beloved Montesquieu.
Well, he's an author that we all think we know, and yet the excerpt that I've chosen for this anthology is his book 20, which is on commerce, and that is not the Montesquieu that we normally
and
think
of. What page
of.
Is this?
This would be on page 290.
290.
And it's in chapter 1, and what he says here is as follows: commerce cures destructive prejudices, and it is an almost general rule that everywhere there are gentle mores, there is commerce, and that everywhere there is commerce, there are gentle mores. Therefore, one should not be surprised if our mores are less fierce than they were formerly. Commerce has spread knowledge of the mores of all nations everywhere. They've been compared to each other, and good things have resulted from this. Now, this passage is interesting at a number of different levels. At one level, it's a typical example of Montesquieu's distinctive method of trying to bind together the economic, the manners and mores, the political, the historical. Because what he's suggesting here is that in different times, in different places, you'll find a different scene. And I find this also a very evocative passage for thinking about globalization as well. Commerce spreads knowledge of the mores of all nations everywhere. And when we compare this knowledge that we have of one country with that of another country, good things result from this. We learn about ourselves by the knowledge that we gain from international commerce with others. I think this is a timelessly important passage, and it certainly had a big impact in Montesquieu's own time.
Well, the final sentence on that page goes back to what I said earlier about the ambivalence that people like Montesquieu have. Commerce corrupts pure mores. It polishes and softens barbarous mores.
Absolutely.
It's an interesting statement, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And this, too, is the characteristic Montesquieu. He's always looking to see both sides of every issue, and he certainly does in his discussion of commerce as well. But on the other hand, it was from Montesquieu that Adam Smith and other Scottish thinkers learned to see modern society as a society deeply and distinctively shaped, not by the laws of the lawmakers, but by commerce. Okay, the third and final passage that I propose for your attention is on 632, actually. And this...
John Miller.
Yes, this comes from a Scot. So we have a Dutchman, a Frenchman, and a Scot. And John Miller, that's spelled L-L-A-R, was a student of Adam Smith's. And he wrote this book on the origin of the distinction of ranks in 1771, and it was an attempt to apply what he had learned from Montesquieu, whom he was deeply familiar with, and the legal history of people that he, as a law professor, was familiar with, and the teachings of Adam Smith to an understanding of the growth of civilization, and particularly the problem of status and social hierarchy. I choose this passage in the middle of 632, however, for a different reason, as you'll see. It reads as follows. In a commercial country, a great part of the inhabitants are employed in such a manner as tends to disperse the members of a family and often requires that they should live at a distance from one another. The children at an early period of life are obliged to leave their home in order to be instructed in those trades and professions by which it is proposed they should earn a livelihood, and afterwards to settle in those parts of the country which they find convenient for prosecuting their several employments. By this alteration of circumstances, they are emancipated from their father's authority. Now, here we have a reference back, actually, to something that we were talking about just a few minutes ago when you asked me about the subject of women. Miller makes it absolutely clear that, in his view, men and women alike have been emancipated to a certain extent by the spread of commercial society. And the mechanism by which that happens occurs primarily in the family. Commercial society makes it less and less possible for the father to hold forth as the one and only fount of wisdom, the one and only source of authority in the life of the young man or woman.
I hope my children don't read this passage.
And mine as well.
But, I mean, again, you can see that this might have a corrosive effect on the family to one extent, but on the other hand, it's liberating for those who feel trapped by traditional patriarchal authority.
There was, as you're no doubt aware, there was a percolating, continuing debate during the whole course of the late 17th and 18th century. In a sense, it was begun, I suppose, with Filmer and Locke in the late 17th century. Certainly, it hadn't petered out by the end of the 18th century on exactly that subject, on the subject of whether young people were just too darn uppity nowadays. Or whether the character of family life had and should have changed in modern times as compared to what it should have been or was in previous times. And what's interesting about Miller is that he puts that debate in the context of the history of commerce.
Well, Hank, thank you very much for talking to us today about your book and your research interests. Thank you very much.
The pleasure's been mine, David.